Does FDA approval of vaccine medicines and other drugs mean that they are safe for our use? Did you know that vaccines are the only pharmaceutical products the U.S. government mandates and completely indemnifies? Would you be surprised to learn that vaccine safety is not settled science as advocates in the media and government contend? Did you know that there is a national vaccine injury compensation program that pays settlements to those individuals and families who are adversely affected by receiving vaccines? Vaccine laws already on the books and being considered in many other states all have the net effect of eliminating medical autonomy, crushing religious liberty, undermining personal freedom, and burdening quality providers with a non-optional series of medical interventions in the form of mandated vaccines. Are we on the road to medical tyranny? Stay tuned for answers to these and other questions. My interview with vaccine law expert and activist, Attorney Alan Phillips, is next here on the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come,
the walrus said.
You talk of other things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
It's called the American Dream because you have to be asleep to believe it.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Alan Phillips is a nationally recognized legal expert of vaccine rights. He's the only attorney in the U.S. whose practice is focused solely on vaccine exemptions and waivers and vaccine legislative activism. He advises individuals, families, attorneys, legislators, and legislative activists throughout the U.S. on vaccine exemption and waiver rights and vaccine politics and law. He hosts his own show, The Vaccine Agenda, is published internationally on vaccine politics and law, and has appeared at rallies and conferences throughout the U.S. Alan is a regularly featured writer for Natural News, GreenMediaInfo.com, Liberty Roundtable, and the Pastoral Medical Association. In addition, Alan is a board member of the World Association for Vaccine Education and the Pastoral Medical Association, an advisory board member of the American Chiropractic Autism Board, a co-founder of North Carolina's Citizens for Healthcare Freedom, and an advisory council member of Thai Healing Alliance International. Alan, welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
It's a real pleasure and honor to be here with you today. Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Alan, you have clearly demonstrated a passion for both educating and advising individuals and organizations about vaccine law and individual rights and responsibilities. What led you into this interest and activism to begin with?
Mike, I've got a couple of children, boys 13 and 21, and when the oldest one was born, a friend of mine told me how another friend of hers had a child who had been permanently disabled by a vaccine. And I had never heard of that. And it was somewhat shocking to me to hear that. I can remember thinking as a teenager hearing something on the radio about a religious group that didn't vaccinate and having what probably in our culture and day then and now for that matter for most people would be a typical reaction, thinking, what idiots, you know, believing
right.
God is fine, but you know, don't not vaccinate. Sort of like the, if you'll allow me here, the trust in Allah but tie your camel first.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that
right.
that metaphor?
Yes.
And yet, when I learned that somebody had been disabled by a vaccine, I was quite confused. And so I went to the library. My library had a book then that I still think is one of the best books for people to get as a introduction to the vaccine controversy, a book by Neil Miller called Vaccines, Are They Really Safe and Effective? And Mr. Miller is an excellent researcher, and he documents, and this is a small book that you can read through in about a half an hour or so, which is why I think it's a good starting book, and yet it has over 300 referenced footnotes to medical literature and other mainstream sources. And I really just never looked back from that point. And at one point in my ongoing personal research, I just made a decision that I wanted to do something more about this issue. And so I went to law school, a so-called second career attorney, primarily because of my concern about the vaccine issue. And I just have never looked back. And the best way I can summarize my now over 21 years of research on the subject is that the deeper I dig, the messier it gets.
Yes. Well, that's something we were chatting before we went on air, and that's something that that I found out too. Is as I was doing the research for this show, I was just amazed at how, to borrow another phrase, how deep the rabbit hole goes. Very surprised. So, Mr. Miller's book then really encouraged and inspired. You've got a book of your own, Alan. You wrote The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, and I was reading some of the reviews, and very impressive. It's been called by many as the go-to manual for parents, students, healthcare employees, parents, military personnel, other attorneys and agencies, virtually anybody that's concerned with legally avoiding vaccines in the United States. And I was wondering, Alan, if you could walk us through some of the things that you cover in your book, and then where can folks purchase that?
Sure. I discovered as I began investigating the issue that there were, and especially as I was studying this in law school and legally, the legal aspects since law school. I graduated law school in 2002. And I discovered that there were a lot of people with a lot of mixed information. In this instance, when I say mixed, I mean a mixture of accurate and inaccurate information in terms of the legal rights. And still to this day, it sort of is curious to me how parents will go out in the social media and ask other parents, non-attorneys, how do I get an exemption here, or how does this work, or whatever. And there are a lot of people with perfectly good intentions and operating from a perfectly reasonable, common sense point of view. However, the law doesn't always follow our common sense thinking.
Right, right.
And so this is certainly not a put down in any way of anybody. It's no different than me trying to rebuild my own engine in my car when I know nothing about auto mechanics. It's, you know, it's a law like everything else in this, you know, specialized area. But a lot at stake here, because as I'm sure we'll get into in a few minutes, there's a huge risk that we take as individuals and cost that we pay as a society by the vaccines. But we'll come back to that in a bit. But the topic of vaccine exemptions and waivers has turned out to be far more broad and deep, both, than I initially anticipated when I first got into and first got out of law school. Vaccines are required in over a dozen different contexts and subcontexts here in the U.S. They're required at birth, for school and daycare, for school and college, increasingly of employees. It's primarily healthcare workers, but that's going to be spreading beyond the healthcare worker field soon, perhaps as soon in a big way, as soon as this coming fall. I am expecting we'll see that happen, but probably no later than next year, if not this fall. Of course, people in the military, which includes military families and military civilian contractors in the military, the legal immigrants have to get vaccines. And another area that I see coming up more and more in my practice is what I call vaccine custody disputes, where parents split up or separate, and in as part of their battle over who has what share of custody of the children, there's a battle over whether or not to immunize the children. And that's a particularly difficult arena because it turns out that there are totally different legal arguments that apply to vaccine disputes in that family law context than the usual laws apply as they apply to any other sort of custody dispute. So family law attorneys don't know how to handle those kinds of cases.
Yeah.
What it boils down to. Now, again, no fault of their own. It's just not something they see very often, and they don't recognize that there's a whole different set of legal arguments. So all these different arenas, international travel and so forth, where vaccines are required, and every one of them has one or more exemption or waiver possibilities. But not everybody can qualify for an exemption or waiver in every situation, and that's just that fact in and of itself raises a question about medical autonomy, medical freedom. Should we have it? Why or why not? Of course, there are a few points on different sides of that fence, but some serious questions raised in all these different arenas. And so the ebook, I'm sorry, the ebook addresses all of these different topic areas. The ebook is divided into a larger part one and part two. And part one provides some background information about how the legal systems work in this country generally. And then with that background, gets into the specific exemption areas to, because with that background, then you can understand better how the law works, where the boundaries are in terms of what does and doesn't qualify for an exemption, in particular with religious exemptions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And bottom line, the ebook is designed to enable people to make informed choices about exemptions and waivers, because it's one of those situations where, I mean, the specific exemption requirements and so forth vary from context to context and situation to situation to one degree or another, but it's one of those situations where if you leave out there without really understanding how the law works and what your rights are, you can qualify for an exemption but do something that costs you the exemption. So it's one of those things where if you know what you're doing up front, you got a much better chance of getting the outcome you want. Attorneys make a lot of money, Mike, bailing people out of situations or trying to bail them out of situations that they could have avoided altogether if they'd just done a short consultation up front with an attorney to learn how their rights work. And this is not a criticism of people, because there are a lot of situations where we wouldn't have any reason to know that we should be talking to an attorney until we get into some sort of a conflict or problem. So, but with any important legal right, anything that's really, truly important to you, whether you consult an attorney or do it in some other manner, it's always a good idea to try and do a little research first and understand, learn more about how the rights work.
Yes. So that sounds like that'd be very valuable information for folks, Alan. And that's, again, that's in the Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions. And that book is available where?
It's on my website, which is vaccinerights.com.
Okay. Vaccinerights.com. All right. Well, we were talking about exemptions. Every place that vaccines are mandated, at least some people are eligible to refuse them legally without penalty. Those exemptions to the vaccine mandates fall into three basic categories, and I'm sure you've covered this in your book, but could you please explain what those three categories are, Alan?
Sure. The one category that is available everywhere is medical exemptions. However, depending on the particular context or category, it can be difficult to get medical exemptions, and I've seen laws and policies go both ways on this. In some situations, they become more and more strict and make it harder and harder to get exemptions. But just a real quick example, I had a healthcare worker, maybe in fall a year ago or even a couple of years ago at this point, a nurse who had letters from three different doctors saying that she should not get a flu shot at work for medical reasons. And the hospital, her employer said, we don't care, get this flu shot or you're fired.
Wow.
And they have gone increasingly in that arena to a really strict criteria. You have to have a history of anaphylactic shock or Guillain-Barré syndrome within 6 weeks of a flu shot. or they won't accept anything else, you know, as a contraindication medically. And it's really, really disturbing. You know, if you got Guillain-Barré syndrome 7 weeks after a vaccine, they're going to say, too bad, you still have to get it again.
Mm.
And if that person is me, I'm looking for a new job, frankly. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't stay there. But I would like to say that I worked with the nurse, and she was able to opt out on religious grounds.
Oh, okay.
So if you know how to approach that arena, that can be an effective way. But I will say, if I may briefly, while I'm working on talking about the hospital context and employee-employer situations, I've probably at this point worked with something on the order of 400 or so healthcare workers all over the country and been very successful in that arena, most of them being able to get exemptions. But it's a really difficult arena because most of the hospitals are just making up their own exemption policies, and they happen to be doing that in a way that's very, very restrictive and that violates federal civil rights law.
Mm.
So it's a difficult, as an example of a difficult arena where you probably do need an attorney's help or should have an attorney's help if it's really important to you to succeed.
Yeah.
Because most people, from what I hear, who try that on their own in that arena are just not successful.
Mm-hmm.
There are other situations where you don't need an attorney at all. You check a box, you sign a form, you go through some procedure, and you get the exemption. So it just depends.
Yeah.
Some situations, you're really well advised to work with an attorney. In other situations, it shouldn't be an issue at all.
Yeah. So that's the medical exemption. You mentioned a religious exemption. How does that work?
Right, and so... Yeah, so the other two exemptions are religious and the personal or philosophical. With religious exemptions, and this is the one that is what I'm involved with most in my work, and religious exemptions are available almost everywhere that vaccines are required. In fact, it's everywhere except school and daycare exemptions in three states now. California just passed a law that'll take effect next year, and it will be implemented gradually over a period of a few years, but the end result of that is there will no longer be a religious exemption or option in California, along with Mississippi and West Virginia. But in most states, with respect to school and daycare exemptions, and then any other context, military, immigration, and so forth, religious exemptions are available. Depending on the particular situation, there are different procedures and different requirements. For example, sometimes you just need to indicate in some very cursory way by checking a box on a form or writing a sentence to the effect of it's against my religious beliefs, and that's all there is to it. In other situations, you have to state the specific beliefs that are opposed to vaccines. And then there's a third category where you have to state the beliefs and the authorities involved have authority to scrutinize exemptions. They get to decide whether or not your beliefs qualify.
Wow.
Anytime somebody has to state their beliefs, that's a situation where people need to be very, very careful. Consider, again, in those situations, consider working with an attorney, because this is a situation where people's common sense approach can get them into trouble.
Yeah.
The question is not about, for example, let me illustrate this with a short story, if I may.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
Really good point. There were a couple of medical doctors arguing on the internet about 3 years ago about whether or not the Bible is opposed to vaccines. And one doctor says, well, of course the Bible is not against vaccines. It was written 2,000 years ago, which I think is kind of silly because I think you can spin that one both ways. Well, of course the Bible is not for vaccines. It was written 2,000 years ago.
Right.
But the problem there for purposes of an exemption or waiver is that that's the wrong question. I love to pick on medical doctors, and don't get me wrong, I have a handful of medical doctors that I think are some of the most wonderful people in the world, but nevertheless, I love to pick on doctors, so I get to pick on both of them this time, on both sides. The question they were debating is a theological question. Is the Bible opposed to vaccines? And there's nothing inherently wrong with theological questions. People are free, of course, and welcome to address those questions, have debates, agree or disagree, or what have you. But when we're talking about the vaccine exemption or waiver, we're talking about a legal right, and the starting question is really a different question. So the question that we need to start with is, how does the law define religion for legal purposes?
Hmm.
and then do any of my beliefs fall under that umbrella? Well, a complete answer to the question for me is about a 2 to 3 hour consultation. I do quite extensive consultations with my clients to explain how the law works and how to write a legally sound statement of beliefs opposed to vaccines and other topic areas that I cover. But in brief, it doesn't matter whether you belong to any organized religion at all. And if you do belong to one, it doesn't matter which one. What matters legally is your personal interpretation of whatever your religion is or your personal religious beliefs if you don't belong to or are not affiliated with any religious organization. You don't even have to believe in God in the Western theological sense of that word to qualify for religious exemption. Now, you do have to meet legal requirements, the legal definition of religion, and there are some very specific criteria there. But as a starting place, it's a wide open door. So this is really good news for me and my clients anyway, because that means I'm able to help many more people. There are still a few laws in some states where they say you've got to be a member of an organized religion, but those laws violate constitutional boundaries. And it's possible to get around that because they're not really legally enforceable. You might, again, that's the kind of situation where you might need an attorney to make the formal legal argument. But I've done that with clients and succeeded, so that can happen. So it's a wide open door as a starting place, but when you have to state your beliefs, there are a number of what I think of or refer to as legal pitfalls. I'll give you a quick example.
Sure.
But because this is really the biggest one, but it's just one of a list. Many people want to get into the vaccine harm aspect of the issue when they're stating their beliefs. And legally, this is, I guess I couldn't say this absolutely, but for all practical purposes, legally, references to vaccine harm are not going to qualify for a religious exemption. So I always tell my clients, if you're writing a statement of beliefs, rule number one is don't mention the vaccine harm or adverse events. You know, start, put that aside, and then go from there.
Yeah, because I could
writing your statement of beliefs.
I would think that would be one of the first things on people's minds that they'd want to get out on paper.
It is, because when you think about it in sort of common sense terms, the vaccine issue for people of faith is a real mixture of a lot of different things.
Yeah.
It's about science, it's about corruption, it's about politics, it's about religion, of course. And, you know, all these different things for most of us are just sort of interrelated and intermixed. And we don't, in our sort of common sense thinking, we don't separate those out and pull them apart. But when you're looking at how the law defines religion and what qualifies for a religious exemption, sometimes we do need to sort of be a little more objective and understand where the law is drawing lines so that we can be consistent with what the law expects. Because if there is a disagreement between you and your school or you and your employer or you and your boss, the military, whatever context you're dealing with, if that dispute goes formal, you know, somebody rejects your exemption and you decide to take some sort of formal step to resolve that, the law, if all works the way it's supposed to, the law is what's going to decide the answer, not your opinion or my opinion about what is or should be a protected religious belief. And this is really, when we talk about what qualifies legally, what we're really talking about is what beliefs are protected by law. And a lot of people get kind of upset at this idea of the government defining religion, but the way that works in this country is not like it does in other countries where they tell you what you have to believe or can't believe or you have to be this religion or whatever. Here, the purpose of the law with respect to religion is only to protect religious beliefs and practices. So necessarily the government has to have some way of drawing a line saying on one side of the line, here are all the protected beliefs and practices and everything else is on the other side. But they don't draw that line in terms of telling you what to believe or what you can't believe. They just draw that line in a very general way in one sense, in that they just require that the beliefs be religious in nature, and then they have to be sincerely held.
Yes.
And, you know, when I do consultations, I'll split hairs on those phrases further. But but as a starting place, it's really just those two requirements, religious in nature and sincerely held. So going back to the doctor example for a moment, the doctor that believes that the Bible is not against vaccines, that is a protected religious belief. The doctor who believes that the Bible is against vaccines, that is also a protected religious belief. Legally, those are both protected religious beliefs. Now, only one of them is going to qualify for an exemption because only one of them is opposed to vaccines. But my point is that for legal purposes, there isn't a right or wrong answer to that question. Theologically, people will have opinions as to what is the right or wrong answer to the question, but for legal purposes, there is no right or wrong answer. There's only, is it religious in nature and sincerely held?
Yes. Which is much broader.
Much broader.
Yeah.
Although, again, when it comes to what specific beliefs qualify, there are traps, so to speak, or pitfalls that people approaching on their own tend to fall into. So if you're in a situation where you have to state your beliefs or where people can scrutinize them and they get to decide if you qualify or not, take some steps to learn more about how the law works so that you're putting only those beliefs of yours that are going to support the exemption.
Yeah, that's good advice. I do know of a specific example where a lady requested an exemption. She worked in a healthcare facility, and they said, well, that's fine. Have your religious leader, your pastor, or whatever you call that institutional leader, write a letter stating that, this is a sincerely held belief. And so that happened, but the organization then rejected that letter because the institutional leader of that woman happened to be her husband. And so they didn't want to accept it on that basis and made them jump through another hoop. I don't know if that was just something they were trying to do to cover any conflict that might arise from that at a later date. But I thought that was kind of odd, that situation.
Yeah, that's I don't know if the word, the specific example is typical, but in a general sense, that typifies what I see in hospitals. First of all, that was a blatant violation of federal civil rights. They can't lawfully even request a letter from a religious leader in the first place.
Mm.
And what I see often in this arena is where the employees, my minister will write me a letter, and they'll get the letter, and they get rejected anyway, even when it's not, as you said, someone's spouse. Because what they're usually looking for in that situation is proof that you're a member of a church that has tenets opposed to immunizations. But either way, the requirement violates federal civil rights law, and this is why the healthcare arena is particularly difficult. And why this is happening is just mind-boggling to me, because if I were involved with implementing any new policy in a large corporate entity where there are hundreds or thousands of employees, I wouldn't think of putting that policy into action until I ran it past the legal department.
Right.
Now, occasionally when I talk to people, they say, oh, we ran it past legal, but I'm sorry, I don't believe that, because this is employment law 101 kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The lawyers may or may not know it off the top of their heads, but it's stuff that's quick and easy to look up. And so it really does seem to me that hospital administrators are just completely, it's hard to know whether it's deliberate or inadvertent, from the outside, but whichever it is, it really seems, I'm using this in a word in a non-legal sense, it really does seem negligent to me on their part, careless.
Yeah. Careless, yeah.
Because you just don't implement a policy without checking with the lawyers first in today's world.
Yeah, especially when just a cursory read of it says, well, that's against the civil rights law. You can't do that. I mean, yeah. Anyway, so you mentioned a third category is the personal or philosophical exemption. Now, that appears to me to not be as accommodating as the first two categories.
Well, actually, this is one. First of all, the only place this shows up is in some school exemptions. The federal government doesn't have authority to mandate vaccines for state residents directly. And so the laws for school enrollment, for example, daycare and so forth, are all at the state level. So every state, every U.S. territory has its own separate laws and spells out they'll have similar and overlapping to a large degree, but even different vaccine requirements and then different exemption and exemption procedures. And about, oh, roughly maybe 18, give or take, states, none of the U.S. territories, but states have a philosophical exemption along with the medical and religious.
Okay.
And the philosophical or personal belief exemption used to be really simple and straightforward to get. And the great thing about it is you don't have to explain or justify the exemption. You just basically have to decide that you're going to exercise it.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is the closest thing we have to the right to make an informed choice.
Mm-hmm.
However, states have been passing laws in recent years and bills in many states attempting to pass laws where they're adding more hoops to jump through for the personal belief exemption. So, for example, in about 4 or 5 states now, you have to go get a medical doctor's signature and get a vaccine education, a lecture about how wonderful vaccines are and how terrible you are for getting an exemption, and don't you really just want to, you know, go get the vaccines like a good little parent. And it really is demeaning. But more than that, I have actually 3 separate legal theories for why those requirements violate the Constitution. But there's a really important point underlying that assertion of mine, and it's this. Legislators all over the country take an oath to uphold the state and federal constitutions.
Right.
But a law is not officially unconstitutional or formally unconstitutional unless a court says so.
Right.
So what this means is that legislators can pass any law they want to as long as they get the votes for it.
Hmm.
It doesn't matter whether it's a great law or a horrible law with respect to does it meet constitutional requirements. And the U.S. Constitution and federal law in general is a higher legal authority than state law.
Hmm.
So whenever a state law involves federal constitutional rights, they have to draft and interpret that law within the boundaries of the federal Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they don't want to, and then they don't have to, and then they pass the law if they get the votes anyway, and then it's up to us to figure out how to get it in front of a judge if we think it's unconstitutional. So when legislators are acting with integrity and when they're really looking, genuinely looking to screen laws on their constitutionality, the system probably works pretty well for the most part. But when they don't care or there are political motivations or whatever else is going on, then bad laws get passed. And there are several vaccine exemption laws now around the country that I believe are unconstitutional, meaning perhaps, to think of it another way, that if it were brought before a judge, I think there's a far better chance than not that the judge would rule that these laws are unconstitutional. We have a very disturbing thing going on in this country on many levels, for that matter, with vaccines and on many other levels outside of the vaccine arena where constitutional boundaries are being stretched or broken or disregarded. This is a very challenging time that we're in in our society and culture right now because a lot of people are just oblivious to what's going on.
Yeah.
Not necessarily any fault of theirs, but and nevertheless, this is occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And vaccines are just one example. They're a big one. It's a really big example.
Yeah, yeah. And we're going to get into some of those reasons here later on in the show. Alan, you're also involved in something called the Pandemic Response Project, or PREP for short. And as I was doing some reading and research on it, I thought, wow, this is a great initiative. Really trying to cover all of the bases. You've got the 3 categories of exemptions that you're trying to explain to people and help them to take the right steps so that they can take full advantage of what is available to them. But the Pandemic Response Project really covers a situation that's completely different from normal everyday life, doesn't it?
It really does. And this was launched during the so-called swine flu pandemic of 2009 and 10. I say so-called because it turned out that while there was a swine flu virus that went around the world, as far as I know, I haven't heard anybody challenge that. the swine flu virus was far less virulent than the regular seasonal flu virus, so there wasn't anything to declare a pandemic about at all in the first place. And yet, the World Health Organization changed the definition of level 6 pandemic. They have 6 levels, and 6 is the most severe one. They changed it so that a mild disease would qualify, being this swine flu, and they declared it level 6. When they did that, it triggered contract clauses between the pharmaceutical industry and countries all over the world, and it forced the manufacture and sale of $18 billion worth of swine flu vaccines, most of which vaccines were never even administered. Here in the U.S., we threw out $186 million of swine flu vaccines that expired and were never used, and there were other countries that proportionally threw out much more than we did.
Wow.
France and Germany had enough vaccines to vaccinate France and England, most of their population, and yet they only administered vaccines to between 5 and 10% of the population.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We hit like 30% here. Anyway, I started getting lots of questions from people, you know, around the country saying, hey, if they mandate swine flu vaccines, how do I avoid it? And I had not considered the emergency context prior to that time. And I learned a very disturbing thing, and that is whenever there's an emergency declared, your routine exemptions, non-medical exemptions, go out the window. They don't apply. You don't have a right to refuse vaccines on religious grounds if there's a declared emergency in most states.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know all 50 states' laws, but at this point, the only state I know of that has an exemption during a declared emergency is Minnesota. And having grown up in Florida, I'm not prepared to move and live in Minnesota. But it was sort of a disturbing realization for me. So the Pandemic Response Project was a response to this realization on my part about pandemics and pandemic laws. And so the idea is to support an initiative to get states to pass laws creating an exemption during a declared emergency. Now, another way I think of this in more recent times is this is just one of a long list of legislative agenda items. But I think it's, for me, it really is the top one, because it doesn't matter what other rights you have, once an emergency is declared, all your rights that apply in routine times, routine non-emergency situations, go out the window, at least temporarily.
Yeah.
So if you say, I'm not going to get a vaccine, I don't care if there's no exemption or not, this is somewhat of an open question in terms of the formal legal answer, but they probably don't have legal authority to physically hold you down and inject you, although if people are scared, that's going to happen.
Right.
But they can decide, authorities can decide to quarantine you, and they get to decide where and how long, and there's a whole list of different factors. Now, you have to look at each state's laws, because the laws vary from state to state to one degree or another, but many states... This was actually something that was connected, at least temporarily, with 9/11. In December following 9/11, only 3 months later, the CDC started pushing model emergency health laws that most states around the country adopted. They rode the wave of fear from 9/11 to push through overreaching laws.
Mm-hmm.
And by overreaching, what I mean is that most health authorities now, state health authorities, have authority to take action in an emergency, to declare emergencies, and in an emergency that really overstep proper legal boundaries. They have authority that doesn't have proper checks and balances.
Mm-hmm.
And, it seems all too convenient. You know, it seems to me that it was probably planned well ahead of time.
Yes.
But in any case, there are some very aggressive laws in place now, and this has also been going on mostly very quietly at the federal level as well, so that there are a lot of disturbing laws about how much food you can stock, for example. There's just some crazy things going on. But in any case, long story short, the PrEP agenda is to get laws passed at the state level giving us the right to refuse vaccines in a declared emergency. If you have concerns about routine immunizations, and there are a lot of good reasons for that that I hope we have time to talk about, you should be even more concerned about emergency vaccines because they do what they call fast-track those vaccines. They skip a lot of steps so that they can get them produced more quickly and in large quantities so they have them for the emergency. Makes sense on that level, but when you're skipping steps that have to do with safety and effectiveness, that raises a question about whether you should get that emergency vaccine at all.
Right.
And yet we have less information when they are fast-tracked.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, Alan, there is a there's a persistent belief in America that vaccines have been responsible for drastically reducing outbreaks of disease and illness. What I've studied and looked at in the last week or so indicates otherwise. That is simply not the case, and what I mean by that is by the time that vaccines were introduced, these diseases and illnesses, the historic ones that we've had in America, were already well on the decline and on their way out. Is that an accurate representation of the facts?
Well, as I understand it, we have to make a distinction between morbidity and mortality, and that is between disease incidence and then the death rates from the diseases. So if you look at the death rates across the 1900s of the childhood infectious diseases, you see a steady decline from the early part of the 1900s to the middle and later part of the 1900s, except for polio. That's a separate one. We'll come back to that in a minute. But all the rest of them steadily decline, if you're looking at a graph over the roughly 100-year period there. And so it starts at the upper left and goes down to the lower right, steady decline. And then you look at the place where the vaccines were introduced, and on average about 90 to 95% of the death rate decline from these diseases preceded the introduction of vaccines.
Yes.
Now, in a more general sense, it's my understanding that vaccines may have suppressed in some way the incidence of disease. It might be that that's actually a positive benefit as far as it goes, that there's lower incidence of disease. But the death rate decline, for all practical purposes, preceded the introduction of vaccines. And there were many diseases that we've never had vaccines for here in the U.S., and they declined right alongside the ones that did have vaccines. So vaccines are not the reason that we have low disease death rates. And that's the most important point. Now, is there a lower disease incidence from vaccines? Possibly, but at what cost? Because we're at a point now where the data we do have shows that there are more people dying from the vaccines than from the diseases. And the data we have, according to multiple sources, and I say multiple sources, this includes people from the FDA, the CDC, so government agencies, but also some non-governmental agencies, the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, the National Vaccine Information Center, grassroots nonprofit organization. All of these different agencies estimate that only about 1 to 10% of serious vaccine adverse events, the severe injuries and deaths caused by vaccines, only about 1 to 10% of that ever gets reported. So the federal government has this, as you mentioned in your introduction, I think, as a national vaccine injury compensation program. It pays out money to people or families of people where there has been a serious injury or death from a vaccine. Over the life of that program, it's been about 25 years that it's been paying out money now. It's paid out over $3 billion, over $3.1 billion. And the last 5 years, it's averaged more than $220 million a year. And yet that may only be 1 to 10% of what's actually going on. So what we don't know is vastly more disturbing than what we do know right now. But this is a really key point, because the vaccine issue is inherently complex. There are multiple diseases, vaccines, aspects to the issue, medicine, politics, legal, and so forth. But sometimes there are parts of the issue that just boil down to a really clear, focused, concise point.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is this. You know, nobody can accurately say that, well, there's a net benefit from the vaccines. This is something we hear in the mainstream media all the time. Well, there's a net benefit. We have no idea if there's a net benefit or not, really, because most of the data isn't there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Doctors, there was congressional testimony a few years ago that medical students are actually taught not to report suspected vaccine adverse events, and yet they're required by federal law to report events that occur within a certain time of administering the vaccine. They don't even have to personally or professionally think it has anything to do with vaccines, but they're required to report it.
Yes.
They're not reporting it.
Yes.
The vast majority of them. And there are surveys that have looked at this. So these are not people just making up numbers and guessing. The NVIC did a survey of New York pediatricians once. 2.5% of the surveyed pediatricians said that they report.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, according to federal law. So, yeah. But there's no penalty in the law for not reporting, so they can report or not. And they get a lot of pressure from their industry, from their employment arena there to toe the party line in terms of what promotes and supports the pharmaceutical agenda. And it's a multi-billion dollar industry.
Yes, yes,
so,
it absolutely is.
A lot of pressure financially to support that system.
Well, Alan, I think we're right on the doorstep of addressing this question. Why should people be concerned about vaccines? We've been leading up to that, and so I guess maybe now is a good time to step through that door and start answering some of those questions, starting with health concerns and some of the suspected side effects. Would you please share some of the dangers inherent in many of the vaccines routinely given today?
Sure. Well, this is something that's been documented in the medical literature for literally decades. And the side effects range from anything from, you know, minor redness or swelling at the injection site to permanent disabilities, neurological, immunological, or both, to death.
Yeah.
It's just a wide range of different types of adverse effects. There's a huge controversy, of course, over whether or not vaccines cause autism, and I was at a conference just a couple of months ago with some researchers sharing information about this. The CDC, the researchers in this conference said, relies on a handful of studies. It's maybe 12 or 13 studies. Another researcher just last night said there was only 6 or 7, but a relatively small number of studies that they claim prove that vaccines don't cause autism. The researchers at this conference said there's over 160 published studies that show that there is a connection between vaccines and autism. And we hear people in the mainstream media, people who, many of them in good faith, frankly, towing the party line, that they're just misinformed because they haven't gone out and researched it for themselves. This is really the big issue. Well, how could, you know, a majority of doctors be wrong? These are really smart people. They got into medical school.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, these are, you know, many, many brilliant people. You know, you've got to be really academically on the ball to be able to compete and get into med school, let alone get out of it, get through the medical boards and so forth. So doctors deserve some, you know, recognition on that level. However, they don't have time in medical school. They don't have time when they're in practice to go out and research this. They basically, whether they think of it this way themselves, they're following orders. Somebody else is supplying their information, both in medical school and beyond. And we could talk perhaps about the well-documented corruption in the medical publishing industry.
Yes.
Let me just give a very, very quick summary.
Please.
Because this is a source of information. You know, doctors don't all go out and research this independently. They're following what should be reliable sources.
Mm-hmm.
Well, people from the New England Journal of Medicine and The Lancet, among other publications, and these are two of the world's most prestigious medical journals, And we have editors from those journals saying that you can't trust the medical literature anymore. Literally, they're saying that, and others that have said, experts in who have studied the medical literature in terms of its reliability. And they will tell you that it's really toss of a coin as to whether any given medical study's conclusion is actually accurate or not. There are a number of different problems in that industry, but probably the biggest one is the money. You know, the researchers are pressured into coming up with the right result, whether the science does that or not. But right. When they write it up, they better come up with the right result or they're not going to have a job. Because there are millions of dollars on the line, maybe billions, depending on the outcome of a study. So we do not have free speech in the medical world in any practical sense. It might technically be in there somewhere, but in the practical day-to-day world, no, it doesn't exist. You come up with the right answer regardless of what the science tells you, regardless of what the real data is. And I know situations anecdotally where people have been told to change the data.
Yes.
You know, change the numbers. So it doesn't mean every study is wrong. There's good studies out there, but you can't tell by reading the conclusion of the study. But this is what doctors go by.
Yeah.
And they should be able to go by it, so we can't really blame them for it,
right.
Per se.
Right.
If the
FDA,
the majority of doctors can be wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and to your point, if the FDA has approved it and says that it's safe for use, they're gonna prescribe it.
And we should be able to trust the FDA. But there have been, I know, at least one instance where a whistleblower came forward and he said he was a medical doctor who was a researcher working for the FDA. And he's having a discussion with his boss at the FDA, and he said the boss said something about the pharmaceutical industry being their client, and the doctor assumed that his boss had accidentally misspoke and meant something else. He says, "You mean the American people?" And his boss says, "No, I mean the pharmaceutical industry. That's our client."
Yeah.
Now, of course, that's not who's supposed to be their client, but
that's right.
The point of this story is that the way the world is supposed to work and the way it really does work are often two different things.
Yeah.
And when you've got billions of dollars involved, money after a certain level just takes on a life of its own.
Yeah.
There's a real simple and I thought interesting way that somebody described this. When you're a millionaire, you get to play. You get to buy the cars, the houses, do the trips, the planes and boats and whatever. You get to play. When you're a billionaire with a B, you are at an entirely different order of magnitude. There are far fewer of them. There are actually 500 or more billionaires on the planet. I had no idea there were that many until I looked it up once. But in any case, when you're a billionaire, you're playing an entirely different game. That's the level where you manipulate and control populations.
Mm-hmm.
That's the level where the world is your chessboard.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the people, and many of them in the financial industry, international bankers, those are the people who operate outside of political boundaries, outside of legal boundaries, who they have more money than you can buy anything with, so they don't care about having more money in terms of personal toys and so forth, but they can use that to control and manipulate other people.
Yeah.
Like one of the Rothschilds several decades ago said, "Give me control of a nation's money supply, and I care not who makes its laws."
Right, yes.
Boy, is that a revealing statement.
Yes.
That's what we see playing out today, although I think most people are not aware that that is indeed what really is playing out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people say, "Oh, vote for so-and-so candidate." I've gotten to where I just say, you know, it really doesn't matter who gets in, because the president and other political positions are often really more figurehead than real power.
Yeah.
The people pulling the strings are the international bankers that are controlling the money supply. And that's a whole other story we won't get into now.
We'll save that for another conversation.
Yeah. One worthy of exploration on your listeners' part, I would propose.
Yeah.
But the problems with vaccines, what are the problems with vaccines? They're many and varied. And there is a wonderful medical doctor here in the U.S. in Ohio, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, who put together a website that she calls the Vaccine Research Library. and she has collected over 6,000 peer-reviewed published medical studies from around the world, and she has someone working on this every week, adding new studies that are showing problems with vaccines. So when you hear somebody say, oh, the occasional study that claims there are problems with vaccines, those are just the bad studies. You know, that's what they want to do, to dismiss anything contrary to a pro-vaccine agenda. Oh, those are the bad studies. Well, then there are over 6,000 of them that this one source has compiled so far, and that's a lot of bad studies.
It sure is.
You know, so... Yeah, maybe some of the studies are bad, but I bet a lot more of the ones that support vaccines are bad, if you want to really get into
studies.
And there was a medical researcher, Dr. Vera Scheibner, who has been in Australia for originally from Eastern Europe, but ended up in Australia for many decades. She was a senior researcher for the Australian government for many years and had over 90 peer-reviewed published papers to her credit. She actually went through the medical literature over a period of decades, study by study, not just looking at the conclusions, but analyzing the studies, going back and looking at the data and so forth. And she concluded, she wrote a book published a few years ago now, but she concluded that there wasn't any research out there showing that vaccines were safe and effective, and that to the contrary, that when you analyze the data that was out there, that vaccines really don't offer anything constructive, but they cause a lot of harm.
Wow.
And it's, yeah, really disturbing. And she had some specific research that she had worked on herself with her husband, and she wasn't even looking for a problem with vaccines. They were just looking at infant breathing patterns. And they discovered that there was a very specific change in infant breathing patterns in direct association with the administration of vaccines, and that the so-called SIDS cases, sudden infant death syndrome. Now, that's just a label that doctors give for an infant death when they don't know what caused the death. Yeah. They call it sudden infant death syndrome. Mm-hmm. It basically is a fancy word for we don't know what the heck happened. Well, what Dr. Scheibner discovered was that there was a specific breathing pattern that followed the administration of a vaccine, and it was a radical change from the pattern before the administration of vaccines, and that there were certain points in time, 2 weeks out, 30 days out, and a couple of months out even, from the administration of vaccines, certain points where the breathing patterns got really erratic. And that point corresponds to a huge percentage of sudden infant death. So she estimated that, well, I think at least half of the so-called sudden infant death cases were actually directly tied to vaccines.
Wow.
And, of course, she tried to go public with the information and did get it out there to some extent, but that would, of course, have been vigorously resisted by the pharmaceutical industry.
Sure.
Because you have to understand what the industry's dealing with here. They had all these blockbuster drugs. A blockbuster drug is a drug that's going to gross $1 billion or more. All these blockbuster drugs where the patents were running out. Mm-hmm. So the generic companies could come out with generics and compete with it after a certain period of time. Mm-hmm. So they needed to put their financial eggs in another basket. What the basket they have chosen is the vaccine basket. So they got this law passed in 1986, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, that left them with virtually no liability for the death and disability caused by the vaccines.
Can you imagine that?
If they promised to be good little scouts and try to come up with safer vaccines, but there's no financial incentive and there's no legal mandate for them to come up with safer vaccines.
Alan, I want to make sure our listeners caught that point. I don't want them to miss that. This act was passed at the insistence of the pharmaceutical companies. So Congress passed an act that basically said, if you'll continue to make available vaccines, we won't hold you liable for any adverse effects. Is that what you just said?
Yes, because in the early to mid-1980s, the vaccine manufacturers were going out of business because of the payments they were having to make to people injured or the families of people killed by vaccines.
Yeah.
If this happened in any other industry, we would say, fix your product or go out of business.
Yes.
But with vaccines, they have convinced us that vaccines are so necessary that we have to go ahead and keep injuring and killing people. In fact, we have to make even more and more vaccines so mm-hmm. that even more people will be injured and killed by them, but the profits will, you know, escalate astronomically. Again, it's a multi-billion dollar industry growing at a very rapid rate because there are literally hundreds of new vaccines in development and no reason not to, from my purely cold calculating financial point of view, no reason not to have as many people be required to get as many of them as you can because that's just, I don't know, greed knows no boundaries.
Right.
The only way I can think of to summarize that. So they were going out of business. Congress stepped in and saved their butts and said, okay, you no longer have to pay for this in court. There's a tax on each individual vaccine. I think it's 75 cents. But, of course, they just raised the price. It's not like it's any money out of their pockets. So that goes into a fund, and then when somebody's injured or killed by vaccine, you can petition this vaccine injury compensation program. And by the way, anybody who's dealing with this, you do not have to pay a dime for the attorneys. Mm. There are about 140 attorneys around the country. You can work with any one of them anywhere in the country. Doesn't matter where you are or they are.
Yeah.
And it doesn't cost you a thing to get into that program and try to get some compensation. So if you or a loved one has been injured or, God forbid, killed by a vaccine, you can get help. You don't have to go through the system by yourself because you can't afford an attorney. So I just really want to make sure people understand that point.
Yeah.
And I've got a referral list on my site, the vaccinerights.com site. Go to the bottom right-hand corner of the home page, vaccinerights.com. There's a link to a whole list of attorneys that have agreed to be on my referral list, the ones who do vaccine injury cases, because I don't do that. I work only with exemptions and waivers.
Yeah. Okay.
But yes, vaccines do cause these problems. Let's see where I got off my track there. I was talking something about the act there. The industry now has no liability for the injury and death caused by their product. So it's a wide open door from their mm-hmm. point of view, again, from the pure coal and calculating point of view. It happens to be a horribly immoral and unethical thing to do given the harm that we know is caused and the fact that we know there's probably literally 10 to 100 times more harm that we haven't documented.
That's right. Yeah.
So,
and for our listeners, Alan, that may be asking this question, why haven't I heard about all of these things? Well, you need to understand the role of the media in this, and this is something that that I try to point out to people all the time, and that is that the media, they're a business, they're a corporation, a company, and they're owned by other corporations and companies, and the truth of the matter is that the media is owned by Big Pharma. There are connections there that you can trace, and so the message that you're going to get from the media is going to be Big Pharma friendly. So you're not going to hear these things if you're expecting to hear it on Fox News or CBS or ABC or one of the mainstream media's outlets. You're not going to hear it there. You're going to have to go to places like Alan's website, vaccinerights.com. I was on there again today. I've been on there many times in the last couple of weeks, and there is a wealth of information on Alan's website to substantiate and back up all of the things that we've been talking about. And for our listeners, they can also go to PandemicResponseProject.com. That's another website that you have, isn't it, Alan?
Yes, and I probably will eventually combine those two because I originally saw the Pandemic Response Project and my legislative activism generally as something separate from my practice working with individual clients with exemptions and waivers, but it's all sort of interrelated and intermixed. And so,
yeah.
I'll probably pull those into one site. But right now it's two separate sites, vaccinerights.com and then pandemicresponseproject.com.
Okay.
That's where it's all spelled out.
Alan, how can... Go ahead.
So I was just going to say, I just want to follow up on your media comment.
Yeah.
The pharmaceutical industry is the largest advertiser in mainstream media. So,
yes.
Of course, they're not going to allow much of anything negative about the pharmaceutical industry to be said because they would risk losing support from the industry on that level. But I think what you said is probably accurate as well, that the relationship, you know, there used to be a couple of dozen different media companies in this country, for example, and over the last couple of decades or so, they have consolidated. There's only four or five, I think, now, maybe six, but there's been a consolidation on many levels, but the mainstream media is one of them, where there's fewer and fewer companies. And what that means is there's fewer and fewer people controlling more and more of the media.
Exactly.
Exactly what that boils down to. So, yes, and this is important. This goes back to the comment I said earlier. When you get into the billion-dollar level, you're controlling populations. Well, how do you control populations? There are many different ways you do that, and depending on what specific agenda you're talking about. But propaganda, controlling people psychologically, psychological techniques are much more effective than simply asserting facts.
Right.
And yet we tend to think and act as though we're getting factual information, and if something wasn't factual, then it wouldn't hold up, and nobody would go there, and nobody would sell vaccines if they were really hurting as many people as Alan Phillips says they do. Nobody would really do that. And so that's a psychological barrier. That's not a fact. You know, and so we have to learn to recognize that we think we're free in this country, and we have certain freedoms that other countries don't. There's no question about it. But the extent to which we are free is something that is, in my opinion, different than what most of us think it is or think of ourselves as being free. And it's ironic, but I think true, that one of the things that makes us easy to manipulate is the fact that we think we're free and it can't happen here.
Yes.
So we're not looking for it.
Right.
And we're not going to see it sometimes even when it's there in front of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's sort of ironic, but this is an example. What kinds of control? Well, when you have, you know, billion-dollar budget to control people with, you're going to unfortunately do things that are going to cross moral, ethical, and even legal boundaries. And let's look at the pharmaceutical industry briefly on this point, because this really helps bring it home.
Yeah.
This is an industry that routinely engages in massive criminal behavior. Now, this is not an exaggeration for effect. This is a documented fact. The industry routinely gets criminal fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and criminal fines have been as high as $1 billion in this industry. And it has gotten worse in recent years. There was an 8-year period where there were over 20 fines. Now, these were combined criminal civil fines, but 20 fines that were between $345 million and $3 billion. And who knows how many countless other ones that were only in the lower hundreds or tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when I say this is an industry that routinely engages in massive criminal behavior, I mean that as objectively and factually as I can, even though I have, I'm sure, some emotion in my voice when I'm saying this, because I'm just so appalled and outraged and scared, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Most of this, as I understand it, has to do with the illegal marketing of prescription drugs, but this is another one of those quick, concise, bullet point kind of things. Nobody should ever be required to take a product from an industry that engages in massive criminal behavior.
Yes. Yes.
But here's the thing. If they would engage in billion-dollar crimes, do you think they might lie to the media? Do you think they might lie to the public? Do you think they might lie to legislators?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they might employ psychological techniques to further their private agendas? And I tell you, with a billion-dollar budget, you're darned right, they do all of these things.
Yes.
And with a track record of billion, you know, $100 million and even billion-dollar crimes, yes, these are people who will do whatever they need to get away with it.
Yeah.
So the Justice Department, the Federal Justice Department bragged, and I think with some degree of validity, that in the year 2014, they pulled back in $3.3 billion that had been, that the pharmaceutical industry had attempted to take unlawfully by committing fraud with federal health programs. $3.3 billion they got back. But I heard an estimate that in the U.S. every year, the industry commits about $60 billion worth of fraud.
Oh, my.
So if you're a psychopath who is a CEO of a corporation, jumping a couple of steps there that we can come back to if you'd like, but
sure,
if you're purely focused on the bottom line,
mm-hmm,
and you're trying to maximize profits, and if no one goes to jail, which is the case with these criminal behaviors, or of course they wouldn't be doing them,
right,
no one goes to jail, if you're going to get away with $60 billion worth of fraud and you're going to have to pay three or heck, even five or gosh, a really bad year, $10 billion in fines, that's a $50 billion profit. You know, one could argue, I'm not making this argument, one could argue that they're obligated to their to their stockholders,
yes,
to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody's ever obligated to cross legal boundaries or even moral and ethical boundaries, but this is a problem. I know I'm going to raise some eyebrows with this next comment, but I'm just going to call it like I see it.
Yep.
This is a problem with the free enterprise system that we have, capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, there are some upsides. The competition brings out creativity and innovation. That's a wonderful thing. But it also brings out immoral, unethical, and criminal,
yes,
behavior. Because if you're competing head-to-head with another company and you've done everything legal and moral and ethical that you can to get ahead, then you, at the point that you reach those, the edges of those boundaries, you are then confronted with a question. Do I step over those lines?
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of us, I like to think, don't step over those lines.
Right.
Or if we do, you know, we drive 70 in a 60 zone or something like that, but we're not engaging in the sort of criminal behavior where in the healthcare industry people suffer and die needlessly as a result. But we need to understand that there are people within our population, some of them very intelligent intellectually, doctors and so forth, who would do that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, again, there's just something about money when it reaches a certain level, and I'm just sort of arbitrarily talking about the billion-dollar level here to make a point,
mm-hmm,
somewhat arbitrarily, but there's a certain point, whatever it is, that when money reaches a certain level, that it will do anything it needs to further itself. And there are people in decision-making positions who will do things that you wouldn't do and I wouldn't do. And who knows, maybe if we were in that position, we would too. You know, I'd like to think I would never do that, and I hope I'm never tested on it. But who knows? Maybe it's something inherent to human nature. But regardless of whether it's just some sick people or human nature or whatever,
mm-hmm,
there are people in decision-making positions who know what they're doing, who know that vaccines aren't really helping, who know that vaccines are killing and injuring people unnecessarily, who know that there are other alternatives, which we can get into if you'd like,
mm-hmm,
that work better, cost less, and don't injure and kill you.
Right.
But this is highly profitable, and the industry pressure is there to behave in the way that they behave, and they succumb to that pressure. Or maybe somebody somewhere is initiating it, and they do this. And for whatever combination of reasons, I think money is only one of the reasons, but you don't have to go any farther than the money to see serious problems.
Yeah. A couple of examples to back up what Alan was saying for our listeners. I have an article in hand here from Debbie Kidd, and this was back in February, but she was writing about measles vaccines, and she said, and this is a quote, "While those opposing mandatory vaccination for measles are widely portrayed as ignorant and even dangerous by some officials, pundits and even news media accounts, Centers for Disease Control records reveal a startling truth. While no one has died of measles in the United States in the last 12 years, 108 have died as a result of the adverse effects of the vaccine in that same period." So that's one example that she gave. And then she talked about Merck and Vioxx and the deaths that resulted from Vioxx. She says that Merck paid claims to the families of 3,468 users of its Vioxx medication who died of heart attacks or strokes. They paid $4.85 billion settlement fund made to the families of these individuals who died as a result of this medicine. And it was more, and this was the thing that stood out for me, Alan, more people died from taking Vioxx than died on 9/11.
Oh, wow. What a eye-opening comparison that
mm-hmm.
is. And the thing that we have to understand here is that from the perspective of the pharmaceutical industry, this is just a cost of doing business, because they wouldn't do this unless there was a net profit.
Yes.
And the fines have gotten worse. I was looking at fines over, I don't know, it was a 10 or 15-year period. In the first half of the period, you see all these fines and hundreds of millions of dollars. In the second half of the period, you see high hundreds of millions and billions in these fines. It's just gotten worse and worse. But it's this really sick game, because they will keep doing it until upper-level industry people start serving hard time.
Yeah.
And, you know, lawyers in that arena have said, yeah, that's a nice theory, but it's really hard to pin it down to an individual. Well, we need to pass some laws making it, holding the CEOs responsible. If they can't hire people, you know, they are responsible unless they can produce the paper trail, the documentation that proves somebody else down the line is responsible. Mm-hmm. So they've got to set up a system where it either doesn't happen at all, or if it does happen, it is obvious who's responsible, and somebody does hard time for this. Because when somebody dies, and I'm not a proponent of the death penalty, but if we were in an eye-for-an-eye culture, if somebody dies, then whoever's responsible should get the electric chair. And if we did that, and I'm not saying we should do that, but if we did that, you'd see this clean up really fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
You'd see the pharmaceutical industry collapse, frankly, and then the so-called complementary and alternative systems, which actually work,
yes,
unlike the pharmaceutical approach, which seeks only to manage symptoms as a way of maximizing profits,
mm-hmm.
We would see health restored in a phenomenal way in this country.
Yeah.
But it's just, there's a serious lack of integrity here. It's just, yeah. just, and that's a polite way to say it, I guess.
Yeah.
But
that was very polite.
People's lives don't matter, because profit is more important, and as long as nobody is ultimately responsible. Now, I say ultimately. I personally believe, and I bet, Mike, that you would agree with me on this, ultimately, of course, they will be held responsible.
Yes.
But we need some responsibility, you know, here on the physical plane in this lifetime.
Right.
Because yeah. people who are survivors of pharmaceutical industry atrocities deserve some closure, you know, to heal as best that they can, not just physically, but emotionally as well. When you have a child who is functioning perfectly normally, and you take that child, you do the right, dutiful thing as a parent, and you get your immunizations, and suddenly your child starts regressing and becomes severely autistic or has other serious health problems. There's no way to describe the feeling, you know, that you live with for the rest of your life for what you feel like you've done to your child.
Yes.
There's, you know, it's the harm to the child. There's just no way to describe that. There's no way to compensate that with money. I mean, if you can get compensation in the program, great. You deserve more than whatever you could get out of it. But that doesn't fix the problem.
Right.
You know, money right. doesn't make it go away. So it should never happen in the first place. And
right.
that there could be human beings who are so devoid of compassion, who genuinely lack a conscience. And I used the word psychopath earlier. When I say psychopath, I don't mean serial killer. You know, psychopath can be somebody who just simply doesn't have a conscience.
Yes. Right.
Someone who literally lacks the capacity for compassion. Someone who feels no remorse for the harm caused by their words or actions.
Right.
And some people even consider that these people make great CEOs, and some of them are very academically intelligent. They learn early on in life how to behave in a way that looks normal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a learned behavior for them. It's not something that's natural because they have a conscience or feel guilt or anything like that. So there are people, you know, this is another reason why it's so hard for people to believe that there's anything going on that we're talking about. Nobody would really do that. Come on.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry, but you need to wake up, because some people would do it and some people are doing it. You wouldn't
yes.
do it. I wouldn't do it. Most people wouldn't do it. I've seen different figures. Something like 4 to 8% of the population are psychopaths.
Yeah. Wow.
And yes, some tiny percentage of them may end up becoming, you know, the extreme case, such as a serial killer or whatever. But that's just the extreme version. There are many other versions, and some of them blend in well in society. And some people think they make great CEOs because they can focus narrowly and on the bottom line. And ironically, the intelligent psychopaths will rise up the corporate ladder faster than you or I, because they will do things that you and I wouldn't do.
That's right.
And as long as they are intelligent in the sense of not shooting themselves in the foot, not having themselves kicked out completely, you know, so there's a disproportionate percentage of those kinds of personalities in high-level decision-making positions relative to the rest of society. So sort of ironic. You know, we look at somebody like Bill Gates or Donald Trump, and we say, my gosh, these people are models of success. Look how rich they are. You don't get there unless you have stepped over and over and over and over again and again and again moral, ethical, and legal boundaries to get there, because that's the only way you compete in the system we have in place today and come out on top.
Mm-hmm.
So ironically, we have created a system where the worst people rise to the top.
Yeah. So we've got some work to do.
Yeah, it's not literally true of everybody every single time. You know, don't hear, I'm speaking in generalities here. But I think these are points that we need to have in mind. You know, my younger brother once said, anybody truly qualified for the position of president knows better than to run for the office. and he said it, of course, in jest, but there's some a seed of truth in there
yes.
for us to think about.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. So I think our listeners are sufficiently informed now to be asking themselves this question, Alan. How can they get involved where they live in raising awareness of these issues? Any advice for them?
Yes, that's a terrific question, because we need to understand that while ultimately the vaccine controversy is about a scientific question or questions. Are vaccines safe? Are they effective? Are there other alternatives? How do we best deal with infectious disease concerns? These are ultimately scientific questions with scientific answers. But what we do with that issue, we as a society, how that plays out in our day-to-day life is a legal question.
Mm-hmm.
Who has to get vaccines and when? Is mostly about the law. Now, it's increasingly been about becoming, with respect to adults, about employer company policy. But who can say no and when and how is a legal issue pretty much purely.
Yeah.
And so we need to understand where the laws are, and some of them at the federal level and some of them are at the state level. But I think the most important place for the most part, where this plays out is at the state legislative level.
Yeah.
So people need to do one thing, everything you can to get informed and to stay informed and be informed. And there are many people offering information, wonderful information on websites and lots of radio shows that either are about vaccines or that address vaccines from time to time, like this one. And thank you so much for making time in this show to address the issue. I also, as you mentioned earlier, have a radio show called The Vaccine Agenda. It's a weekly show. We talk about vaccine politics, science, and law only, and every week. It's live Monday evenings, and you can find that on blogtalkradio.com, blogtalkradio.com/The Vaccine Agenda. And it's live Monday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's 6 p.m. Pacific time, and then archives are readily available there as well. You can listen to any show that's already occurred after the fact. And it's also rebroadcast with archives at naturalnewsradio.com.
Okay.
So people can find it either one of those, the show, either one of those websites.
Yeah.
But I also have a news page. I have an e-newsletter I send out once a week where I list links to recent news articles about vaccines. So that's a good way to stay up on some of the news. People can sign up at vaccinerights.com. There's a link there on the homepage. So we need to stay informed, and then we need to put that information into action, because it's not enough just to understand what you want to do or don't want to do, because the laws are changing rapidly right now and mostly in favor of the pharmaceutical industry, which means more and more vaccines are being required of children and increasingly now of adults. And our abilities to say no, the types of exemptions that are available or the difficulty in getting exemptions, it's becoming harder and harder to get exemptions. And so this is playing out primarily, again, at the state legislative level. Now, I work with legislative activists all over the country, and anyone who wants to reach out to me and wants my help or guidance, I'm happy to help to the full extent that my time and knowledge allows me to do. There are grassroots organizations all over the country. Some states have well-developed organizations and others less so. The National Vaccine Information Center, a nonprofit grassroots organization, they have chapters all over the country and have been putting together directors with a director for each state to help better help coordinate. So people can go to nvic.org, NVIC as in National Vaccine Information Center, nvic.org, and they have something called their what do they call it? A portal. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank here. Something about portal. But anyway, it's a separate website, which is only about vaccine legislation and primarily at the state level. So you can go to nvicadvocacy.org, nvicadvocacy.org. And you can see a list of some of the current bills around the country right on the homepage, and then people can join the portal if you want to, and put in your address information, which they'll keep confidential. That means that only you, they, and the NSA have access to it. Little joke there. They'll keep that information right. confidential, but if you plug in your address information, they will tell you who your representatives are, state and federal representatives, because you can calculate that from the address. So they have made it as easy as possible for people to participate legislatively. For example, if there's a bill in your state that should be supported or opposed, you know, you no longer have to take on a part-time job to participate in legislative activism. Having said that, there are ways to participate that are more effective or less effective, depending on what you do or don't do. I've got information about that on my website, and again, I'm happy to work with people to help people be effective in that arena. So it is important to be involved. Everybody has to decide for themselves what level of involvement they are able to do or want to do, and there's no judgment on my part about whether anybody's involved or not, whether anybody speaks out or not. But having said that, collectively, if we do not organize and speak out in a coherent voice, the vaccine agenda, the pharmaceutical agenda, rolls forward. There are literally hundreds of new vaccines in development. There's no light at the end of this tunnel. There's always going to be another vaccine to give someone, and always going to be another person to get a vaccine. Every man, woman, and child on the planet is a potential recipient of vaccines from the moment of birth, actually pre-birth. They're actually wanting now to vaccinate pregnant mothers with the notion that the fetus will get a benefit of the vaccine. And the reason in part, or the, not the reason, the rationale at least in part, is that newborn children don't respond to vaccines. That's why they don't give them until, except for the hepatitis B vaccine. That's why they don't vaccinate with a whole battery of vaccines at birth. They give them at 2, 4, 6 months or other time periods, because the studies have shown that except for the hepatitis B vaccine, there's not an antibody response. Actually, studies show that the hepatitis B vaccine is not very effective at birth either, and it can also injure or kill you. The infant, not a laughing matter.
It isn't,
because it does happen,
right?
And it's you know, sometimes you have to laugh to keep from crying, but
right.
It's just so tragic. So get involved any way you can. Feel free to check in with me. People can email me at attorney@vaccinerights.com or just go to my website. Contact information is there.
Yeah. We've been talking with Alan Phillips on vaccine exemptions, vaccine rights, and what's going on in the pharmaceutical industry. Check the information out at his website, vaccinerights.com. Alan, it's been a pleasure to chat with you, and I hope that we can get you back on the show again very soon. There's a number of topics I'd like to explore at a little deeper level.
Well, I would be absolutely delighted to do that. Thank you again for having me. It's been a real pleasure and honor. Appreciate having made your acquaintance and had this connection, and I'm just I feel blessed knowing that you're out there supportive of this cause, and I'm sure many others, and thank you for the good work that you do.
Thank you very much, Alan. God bless you.
You too. Take care.
Thank you. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter, @SoaringEagleRad. And listen to every episode from our website, www.SoaringEagleRadio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek Him.